When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Standard issue for all women.
Hello, Hannah here. Happy Easter if you do that sort of thing. Happy long weekend if you get that sort of thing. And hello to everybody else that doesn't cover. If it sounds like I'm being cautious with my word in there, well spotted. And it's as good a segue as possible into this week's Chops, in which I chat to Courtney Moorhead Balaka, producer of a new documentary, The Coddling of the American Mind. That name sounds familiar to you. It's either because you read an Atlantic article named that, or the book that followed it, both are written by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, or it's because you've heard me, and indeed Mickey, recommending it to you. In fact, I think we'd both say that that's the article we've most recommended to people ever. Its thesis, for those who don't know, is that the current mental health crisis amongst young people, in particular Gen Z in the US, is due not only to social media and the pandemic, which obviously played a large part, but to a culture on university campuses which teaches, for the want of a better word, young people to be vulnerable, and how tribalism, helicopter parenting, and the one strike and you're out culture of public shaming has left young people afraid to make mistakes. And mistakes, as you will already be well aware, are what makes us human. The Coddling of the American Mind is released on Substack, and Courtney also tells me about why that might be very good news for independent filmmakers. If you want to watch the film, which is directed by Courtney's husband, Ted Balaka, and gets a big recommend from me, you can find it at thecoddlingmovie.com. The book, which was published in 2018, is available in all good bookshops, and the article that spawned it can be found on The Atlantic. There's a link in the show notes to all of those things. One extra note, we talk about FIRE, which, if you don't know, is an American nonprofit, otherwise known as the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. I started out by asking Courtney how she and Ted first heard of The Coddling of the American Mind.
We've known Greg Lukianoff, one of the co-authors, for a very long time. He's back in 2016. We partnered with FIRE to make another feature documentary about a different topic. It's called Can We Take a Joke? And it was about, this term wasn't even in existence then, but cancel culture and comedy. We called it outrage culture, outrage mob. Comedians getting in trouble and for telling jokes, and artists getting in trouble for basically free speech. And so we worked very closely with Greg and FIRE, and we thought at the time when we released that movie focused on comedy that things were going to get better in terms of artistic expression and freedom. And that's not really what happened.
I hope.
And then while all that was going on, Greg and John wrote the Atlantic article, and then they wrote the book, and my husband read the book. And we have a son who is, at the time when that book came out, he was only like six. And it was really astonishing, the research that they detail in the book about the mental health crisis among this very specific generation that our son will be in not too far from now. He's nine now. And we found it really alarming. So my husband read the book. We talked about it. I read the Atlantic article as well. And we thought, this is topical. And even while we were in production, I mean, there were just so many articles and studies coming out in the United States about the rising suicide and depression among what we call Gen Z, college-age students. Now, it's mainly focused on America. I don't know what the stats are in your neck of the woods or Europe. I think there's also a problem among that generation. I think it's not just what's going on here. I think that there's definitely a global problem that needs to be discussed. And that's how it all started. We went to Greg. We knew of Jonathan Haidt and his work, huge admirers. We had never worked with him. We pitched our idea. We think this needs to be a movie. We think this needs to be a feature doc. And they loved the idea. So we hit the ground running, and then the pandemic happened and the world blew up and shut down and blew up again. And then things just seemed to get worse with the mental health crisis coming out of the pandemic. And it just felt like it was getting younger and younger. And, you know, with documentaries, it's a little easier to stay in production during shutdowns because you're not dealing with these huge crews and acts and things like that. So we were able to stay in production. It took us a lot longer, obviously, to finish because of the shutdowns. But that's the genesis of it. And we finished the film last year, and we just released it last month, February of 2024.
I was totally delighted, I have to say, to see that Jonathan Haidt was in this, because about 2 or 3 years ago, I sent him an email to ask if I could interview him. He was writing some really interesting stuff about young girls and mental health and the internet. I got an email back and I'd never seen anything like it. It basically said, "This is Jonathan's publishers. We've taken over his email because he's so far behind with his deadline for a book he's writing that we've actually like put him in a bubble." It said something like, "I'm pretty sure he probably would have said yes to this, but because he's not allowed to, we're going to say no." What you have here is the opportunity in 2024 to update a thesis that was first put together in 2013. You can see what's happening in real time, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, we noticed, and we can talk about this too, if this is interesting to you, we have screened the film on several college campuses, and we were really scared to, actually. We were mostly scared to see what the reaction of students were, because the movie's about them. It's about their age group. It's about college. It's about what's going on the American college campus. We go to the East Coast in just a couple weeks, and we're going to screen at Harvard, at Princeton, and I can tell you more about that too. But overall, young people and students had a very positive and powerful reaction to it. And I think it was a way, the film, this is what we hoped it would do. It kind of opened up this conversation about, you know, you're on an American college campus and you have these expectations about what your experience is going to be and the friends you're going to make and the relationships. And especially during the past few years, they've just found it to be a very oppressive culture and not a bastion of free expression and free speech, which is what universities were kind of supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, if you go there, grade school and grammar school, and then you're thrown into the den, a safer den than the real den of the world, but to be challenged intellectually and to be able to articulate and discuss your point of view as different as that might be with other people who meet. And in the documentary, as you noticed, we have several international students who came from parts of the world for the American university experience. So they
didn't know what was going to hit them.
they're like, they grew up watching Robin Williams standing on a desk in Dead Poets Society. One girl, She's not in the film, but she's from India. And she's like, I grew up watching Legally Blonde. I thought college was going to be pillow fights and like, hanging out and laughing it up. And she was canceled for something she said that wasn't popular. But what was interesting about that perspective from a foreign student, it's like they really did have this image of what the American college campus was. And for many of them, it was completely different. It was not come here and saying what you want and feel and think and challenge it and challenge others. It was choose your side.
Yeah.
Choose your activism. And if you don't really fit in. And if you choose the wrong one, you don't really have a crew of people. And it was very strange for many of them. And frankly, you know, my husband and I were obviously not even close to Gen Zers anymore, but we went to college, and just listening to these stories and how they felt, like thinking one thing but saying something completely different because that's what's expected of them, that's really psychologically dissonant. And that'll mess anyone up after a certain point. And that's not what I remember from college. So it was fascinating as we were making the movie. You know, obviously the pandemic happened and that was kind of weird. And then as we released the movie, the war in Israel and Gaza broke out. And lots of havoc has been wreaked on college campuses out here. I don't know how much you guys know about it, but you know, pro-Israel, pro-Palestine protests happening on college campuses. Deans resign because of sides they're taking or points of view. So I'm hoping that the film, which really is about, guys, we can't get caught up in these cognitive distortions, which is really what the book is about, right? We're really talking about. It's like a lot of the mental illness that's happening. Yeah, social media is a part of that. Of course it's a part of it. But a lot of it is just this cognitive distortion that young people are not only experiencing, they're almost being taught to do.
It's important to us because, you know, America sneezes, the world catches a cold. This has been absolutely sort of supercharged through social media to infect all of Europe. You know, all of us have this same culture that's growing on university campuses. They are having a mental health crisis. What the question you're asking is, how do we fix it?
How do we get on? Yeah.
It's so interesting because I live in Cambridge. I worked on the local newspaper here for a long time. So I sort of saw the early stages of this happening at Cambridge University. There were a couple of instances in 2003. Jean-Marie Le Pen was going to talk at the Cambridge Union and there was a massive backlash towards that. And then in 2013, Julian Assange was here and there was a conversation about a man who had been accused of rape talking publicly and exactly the same thing happened. But what's really interesting is in both of those cases, the event went ahead. There was a massive protest outside and the event went ahead. That to me is perfect. That's everyone's getting their free speech there. I would be the sort of student that wanted to go in and have a go at Jean-Marie Le Pen's argument. That's who I would have been in 2003. But what I think now is I can't imagine if either of those events were going to happen now that they would go ahead. I think for me, that's what's changed. I think the pressure is built to such a stage now that those people wouldn't, you know, just would not be allowed to be on the stage.
Really?
Yeah, I think. I mean, I sometimes wonder whether like James Baldwin versus William F. Buckley happened on the stage at Cambridge Uni. And I wonder whether that would ever happen again, which would be a massive loss because it's an incredible debate. So tell me about the five young people that you interview. Where did you find them?
So, yeah, it's a great question. And I really have to credit my husband, Ted, because he found them. And it was all over the place. His background is in journalism. So he used to produce for ABC Network News in New York. And that's how you cut your teeth as a journalist. You're finding the story. And then you're also finding the best people to interview who can help tell that story to viewers. Some of the young people that were featured in the documentary, Greg Lukianoff knew because of all of the work he does on college campuses. Fires very much still engaged in universities and defending free speech and free expression in that world. And some of it was just Ted digging around the internet, Instagram, TikTok even, which we're not TikTok people. Some of it, I read the book and it changed their lives. And some of them hadn't, but were in the midst of coming out of this. Like Kimmy Katiti, she's the young woman from Uganda. And she had actually not read the book when we met her, but she was sort of dabbling in these ideas. Like she was already reading Jonathan Haidt, already starting to kind of get into philosophy, a lot of the stuff that Haidt writes about. And she was interestingly just kind of coming to it on her own. She was sort of reading it while we were working with her, from what I understand. And she, to her credit, I mean, really was realizing just within herself that this is not how I want to live. I'm a very deeply unhappy person. That's not who I was before I came here. And now I'm starting to identify the reasons why. And then she read the book and it was very illuminating to her. So yeah, it's sort of a messy way of saying there wasn't like a clearer path to find them. It was really just kind of you throw out a net and then you see what comes back. And then you start having conversations to see, you know, how much is this person willing to tell their story? How deep are they willing to go? How closely related to the conversation we're creating with the film is it? And I think it was just somebody, you know, sprinkled pixie dust on it. And we're so blown away by the beautiful lines and thoughtfulness and humor and life that they just had intrinsically. And we were just really blessed to have met them and found them.
They say some incredible things. I mean, not just incredible things as in really, really quite profound things sometimes. But I think if I was going to, you know, go with the most negative possible argument you could have about the way young people communicate with each other and the way the in-groups interact, you'd say something like, you're constantly told your opinion doesn't matter because you're a man or because you're white or because you're straight, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you get the opportunity to shine, you really grasp it. And then actually, one of them does say that. Quite incredibly, one of them actually says, now I had something I was allowed to say. That is really quite indicative. Were you surprised by some of the stuff that came out of their mouths?
Absolutely. I mean, quite a few things surprised us. In terms of one of the surprising things we learned from one of our interview subjects, Lucy. She's the young woman with the dark pigtails who has autism. And we were really blown away. And she describes this in the film as someone with autism. She had just been in a psychiatric hospital. She had dealt with psychiatric problems. They didn't really diagnose her until that time in her life, just before she got into Stanford. But her perception of when people would use the phrase a person with autism, I'm not going to take that for granted, that for a person with autism. Like, it's like a person with cancer, a person with something. But her perception was, when you say a person with autism, you're saying that the person and the autism are separate and that the autism is wrong. And that means there's something wrong with the person, which means you think that that person isn't normal and probably shouldn't exist. Therefore, you think people with autism should just be eliminated. And so she would literally go from the phrase person with autism to genocide. And she uses that term, genocide. And when we heard that, I mean, that was such an extreme version of this cognitive distortion that these young people, and we all have them. It's not just young people. I have them. We all have this cognitive distortion. We perceive the world in the way we perceive it. Doesn't mean it's correct all the time. And we have to check it. We have to fact check our own thoughts, right?
Yeah.
That's just normal. That's just being a human. But that perception of just that phrase leading to, well, they think they want me to die. And then to walk through the world, to wake up every day thinking people want you dead. That's horrible. That surprised me, that the extremity of that perception she had. Another thing that surprised me is how guilty I am as a mother of my 9-year-old son. And like, I'm making this movie, and because another part of it that's very important is this idea of free play, not being overbearing to him, let them fail, let them have independent experiences. That's what builds confidence, knowledge, their brains are forming. They build roadmaps when they can figure things out on their own, and they'll screw up and it might scare you and it might scare them, but that's good. I'm really bad as a mom. I want to hover or overprotect and helicopter. And here I'm making this movie. How that's actually not good. It's not good for humans. And so I really had to face, you know, because it's one thing, it's me and it's my kid, it's okay, but everyone else should be free raising it and giving their kids freedom. And I never helicopter when it comes to letting our son express himself with other people. And he's quite good at that, but I am bad at letting him, like, walk to the bathroom at the camping site by himself. So that surprised me just on a personal level.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question, and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much, that does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine. And push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
One other thing that, on the very positive side of it, that surprised me is that once one of these subjects figured out what was really causing this misery and cognitive dissonance and distortion, once they realized that there's a path to get out of it and be free from it, watching other people watch the movie, watch them have that click, was fantastic. Because you never know. You know, you make something, you put it out into the world, and you hope that it has an impact, and you hope you're making your point here. You don't know. And I was surprised by, so far, how many young people voiced it. And almost, I think they were kind of like, I saw many college kids at some of our screenings kind of take a sigh of relief. Like, oh, yeah, it's not just me. It's not, it isn't just my experience or my friend's experience. This is shared. And once you know that you're not alone,
yeah,
it really gives you this groundedness that you can come out of, because you're not just out there in the wilderness alone.
I think what helps as well is that a lot of the language that people use, there's like a uniformity to it. And therefore, it's really easy to recognize your own experience in this, because people are using exactly the same words, exactly the same terms. They go to exactly the same training, or they learn the same things about it.
Yeah.
For me, the bit of this film that absolutely blew my mind was when somebody said they had been to a training session where somebody had asked the question, can you help me find my trigger? And the answer was, you kind of got to interrogate yourself and find it. And I just thought, what are we teaching people? What are we teaching our young people? We are telling them to dig deep and find something to be upset about. That's incredible.
Yeah, that stood out to you, Hannah, because that was another eye-opener for us, too. Like, so someone's basically saying, I'm actually doing all right.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me? we'll find it. We're going to find what's wrong with you. What that? And we're going to get it dark. And we're going to bring you into the vortex. It's like, what? Why? And is it because people aren't comfortable being around mentally stable people because it makes them feel less? I don't know what that is, but I think a lot of it's just what you were referring to. It's just people just get so used to saying the same things over and over that they believe it's true. And that was a fantastic antidote that, Ariane, one of our angry subjects, experienced and brought up. And I mean, even he, you know, he's another immigrant going to college on an American university campus. And even he was just, as young as he was, like, there's something wrong with that. Like, I think it says in the film, like, let her go chasing buttercloth. Yeah, that was wild. That was wild.
Watching it, it's a reminder of how, because I think we sort of underestimate it. What an absolute trauma on the sort of the psyche of the left, both the election of Trump for you guys, and actually for us to watch that was horrible.
Oh, I'm sure.
But and then also Brexit here, this real sort of psychic wound. And it reminded me that I know lots of young people that are around the age now that these children in this are. So they were young people who were age 10, you know, 9, 10 at the time, 2016, maybe a little bit older. And I remember how negative I felt about the future then, and how on quite a few occasions when I was with my brother or with my friends, we'd actually stop talking about the news because we were worried we were going to depress the hell out of them, because they're just soaking it all up. You think they're not listening, and they're soaking up all of this anxiety that you have, that Donald Trump is going to ruin the world. And these are exactly those kids. This is the kids that you were talking to. They're that age group, aren't they?
You see in the documentary, Kimmy, who I was just talking about, I mean, she, a young woman from Uganda, and she was here, and Trump elected, and she was convinced she was going to get murdered. And that's not being hyperbolic. She thought, because of the way that election was framed and regarded, and the emotions surrounding it, she went to, well, I'm gonna die. And I think you even hear my husband off camera say, how exactly were you going to die? She's like, I don't know. But I was convinced, I just, you know, now that he's president, I will die. And then you have the opposite side of the spectrum, where another one of our interview subjects in the film, Saeed, from Nigeria, he gets to the United States. He never even heard of Trump. He didn't even know who he was. And then when Trump got elected, he's like, okay, wait, what's going on? This is that? Okay, why? Again, I go back to my own experience in my 20s. Like, you know, there's certainly controversial things going on. And I was never really involved in politics in college anyway. But I just don't remember, nor do my friends who are my same age remember that level of panic and division and tribalism. Because most people, and it's not my opinion, the book references this really fascinating study called Hidden Tribes. I don't know if you remember that part of the book, where they basically analyze where people kind of fall in terms of their, not even just politics, because that's too black and white. Just how do you perceive the world? Do you think the world is mostly racist? Do you think the world is mostly sexist? Do you think the world is about to end? Do you think the world is in really good shape? And statistically, most people kind of fall in the middle, and there's only 8% that are really extreme. I think this was a U.S. study. I don't think that this went beyond our borders, but it was really fascinating. Hidden Tribes, that when you really talk to people, most people, you don't find extreme life choices or opinions. Most people kind of fall in the middle. They're open to conversation. So I met my husband in New York City. We moved to Los Angeles in the early 2000s. And we would go to dinner parties and with 10 people. And all we had in common was we knew the host.
Yeah.
We take totally different walks of life. We had totally different points of view. It was like early 2000s. And those were some of the best dinner parties, because we just shared our opinion. We talked about how we saw things, and we learned from each other. And we didn't throw cups at each other's heads, and we didn't set each other's cars on fire. We left the dinner party. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that person was really conservative or religious. I didn't know that person was an atheist. But we all learned and gone along. And I know I'm being anecdotal, but I don't see that right now as much. I don't feel it, that sort of comfort to be open and share. And that's the chilling effect that is incredibly dangerous, not just for relationships. It's bad for free expression and free speech. And when people feel silenced and shut down, it's not only really bad for them psychologically, but we're not learning from each other. I don't think civilization usually doesn't get better when people are just silent and afraid. Speaking not what makes a civilization. And this is where Hyatt is just really read it in his analysis and how he frames it. But yeah, usually that's when civilizations start to really go downhill, when we start getting scared to talk.
It's definitely fair. I asked a young person I know what the thing they were most scared of in the world was, and they said being accused of being racist.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
I was blown away by that as an answer. I don't know what I was expecting. Death, cancer, the death of my parents, dogs. I don't know. I was expecting some other answer, but not that. And how do you live with that?
That is so fascinating. That reminds me of one of our college or private college screenings that we did last year. I won't name the name of the college, but the administrator who hosted it, after the screening, we were walking in the car, and he said, you know, pretty much every student I know who's about to graduate, they go back into their social media and just scrub it. They just delete, because they are so terrified that one little joke, one little comment that even was innocuous will be they don't get a job.
Yeah.
The thing they fear the most is not being considered in line with what we call the monoculture. They're not saying, and like, this is a kid, I can't imagine why at any point on earth anyone would accuse him of being racist. But then he's most likely not racist. But it doesn't matter, does it?
No, it doesn't matter. That's the point. Yeah.
Even that is a lot. Because if he's perceived as being that way, that's it. Good luck trying to get out of that. And I mean, you know, we're filmmakers, so we focus a lot on what's going on in our industry with that. And it's bad. People are making creative decisions based out of fear, not brilliance or creativity. And that's bad for art. It's bad for movies. It's bad for plays. It's bad for music. It's completely fear-based. So what you just described to me, I'm not surprised, but what breaks my heart is that it's so young.
Yeah.
Like you've said, it's like, usually it's my parents dying. Think about that. I mean, that is such a powerful cultural presence in such a young person's life. And I don't think that that's healthy. I just don't think that that's going to go in the right direction eventually.
Did you go away from this feeling more positive than when you went into this? Or I suppose more negative would be the opposite of that.
It's a great question. I mean, maybe I'm forcing myself to walk away positive because I feel like I have to believe it. As I mentioned, our young interview subjects gave me hope, especially the ones who were clearly coming out of it with like this sag and his son is coming out and they're not in that position of fear and silence. That gave me hope. I have we have a 9-year-old son. We homeschool him, but we do it with a community of where we live. Homeschooling has gone up a lot since the pandemic for a variety of reasons. But one of our fears with our own child was just sort of this indoctrination.
I've got one more question for you, which is about the release, which is on Substack, which initially my first thought was, oh, that means that not a huge amount of people will end up watching it. And then I immediately corrected myself and thought, it probably means exactly the right people will end up watching it, the people who need to watch it. Do you know a bit more about the Substack model, how you ended up there and what you think is coming next? Because I actually think it's quite exciting. Anyone making more documentaries is good news, right?
Let me first say that making independent film these days and finding distribution is incredibly hard. It's almost impossible because the streamers, they're making their own documentaries. They're not acquiring as many independent films as they used to because they don't need to. They're making their own content. Feature documentaries don't really make money in theaters and movie theaters, so distributing it theatrically just doesn't make sense economically. And it's also very, very hard to market it and bring awareness to the fact that the film exists. And so we were going to go with a very highly respected traditional distributor for the stock. We went down the path with them. But the more we thought about it, and my husband, by the way, is a Substacker. His Substack is called Shiny Herd. And he was really impressed with how the community was building and just kind of how the platform was growing. And it occurred to him that, well, okay, we don't want to release the movie in theaters. We decided that doesn't make sense. Getting into the streamers is possible, but then what happens? Are they going to market it? Are they going to promote it? No. Usually they don't, unless it's like a celebrity in it, or it's about something salacious like true crime, sex, murder, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So we asked for a meeting with the founders of Substack. Chris and Hamish are their names. And we're like, look, you guys have liberated independent writers. It's time to do the same for independent filmmakers. There are a lot of people out there making films and documentaries in particular, and they're finding it difficult to be noticed and find a platform that knows what they are and what the impact can be. And we think Substack could be the right place. We know you guys don't make films, you don't distribute films, but what if we release our feature documentary exclusively on Substack? And by the way, the two authors, Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, huge Substack subscriptions. So they have a presence in this community. My husband has a presence. And Substack loved it. They're like, we've never done this before. It's going to be a huge experiment. Let's try it. So that was the origin of it. It was just like, these days, especially with independent film, you really do have to kind of do something weird and different in order to survive. And we're still in the experiment. You know, we'll see. But one of the carrots on the stick that we gave to them too, it's like, this works. Meaning, if it generates revenue for Substack, if it gets some media attention, there are a lot of other filmmakers out there that you should watch. Yeah. You could become like a little multiplex. You could be, you know, a place for people to go to see the films that you just won't see on Netflix or Prime. And that really excited them too. And you already have like three filmmakers who are like, how's it going? And we're like, so far so good, but we'll let you wait. Thinking about doing it now too. We're like, you should think about doing it. So it's still a work in progress. It's still, but you know, I gotta say, like, we've gotten a lot of traffic and we haven't even publicized the movie yet. Like, we're gonna go to the East Coast, do our New York premiere, which Jonathan Haidt will be at. And do you want to fly to New York?
I mean, I would absolutely love to, but I don't think I could get it away with it on my expenses.
Well, something happens and you find you can, you're totally invited. It's April 18th, the Angelica Theater. Private, it's invitation only, but Haidt will be there. And then we're going to do our little university tour, Harvard, Princeton, Cornell. And we'll start doing some publicity. And I think the way I see it, I think it's going to be a slow burn, meaning we launched, we're starting to do more interviews, we're starting to do more publicity. The trailer was dropped by Barry Weiss's The Free Press. They had a really big Substack. They have the exclusive to release the trailer. They're doing really exciting, interesting things too. And we thought, you know, there's a lot that they're doing that we're trying to do with the film. So that was exciting. So we're still in the experimental phase, but we're live and it's happening. And, you know, I'll keep you posted. But yeah, you can watch the movie. You can either rent it or you can subscribe to the film. It has its own Substack page, of course. The difference is if you just rent it, you just kind of get, you know, the rental. But if you subscribe, you get all the goodies, like behind the scenes. We're going to shoot all of our screening Q&As, including this one coming up on April 18th. And kind of like DVD extras, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, but then if you buy DVD, it's all cool stuff that other people don't get just for renting it. People can go to thecoddlingmovie.com, and that will take you to the Substack page and show you the options on how people can watch it.
Oh, excellent. I hope our listeners give it a watch, but I genuinely hope that young people on university campuses are watching it, because anything that goes anywhere to something this mental health crisis is got to be welcomed. It really has. Thank you so much for your time, Courtney.
Yeah, it was so great meeting you. Thank you.
Standard Issue, for all women.